Ayrım 21.
Nonetheless, some of its central features are preserved by its immediate successors. The moral neutrality of philosophical analysis, the logical gap between fact and value, the interminality of disagreement all remain upon the scene. What is altered in later writers is the attention paid to two intimately related topics, the question of the criteria which are employed in calling things, acts, or people, good or bad, and the question in the nature of moral reasoning. If I call something good or commend it in some other way, I can always be asked upon what criterion I am relying. If I say that I ought to do something, I can always be asked, and what if you do not? And on account of what ought you to do it? What is the relation between my answers to these questions and my beliefs as to what is good and as to what I ought to do? One systematic answer to these questions is to be found in R. M. Hare's The Language of Morals, and his views are added to and further elucidated in Freedom and Reason. Hare specifies the nature of moral language by means of an initial distinction between prescriptive and descriptive language. Prescriptive language is imperatival in that it tells us to do this or that. It is itself subdivided into two classes, that comprising imperatives in the ordinary sense and that comprising properly evaluative expressions. All value judgments are practical, but in different ways. Ought sentences, for example, if they are genuinely evaluative, entail imperatives addressed to anyone in the relevant situation, and anyone here includes the person who utters the sentence. The criterion of uttering the ought sentence sincerely is that, on the relevant occasion, and if the speaker can, he does in fact act in obedience to the imperative entailed by the ought, which he utters to himself. Good, by contrast, is used to commend. To call X good is to say that it is the kind of X we should choose if we wanted an X. The criteria which I employ in calling something good are criteria which, if I am engaged in genuine evaluations, I have chosen and which I endorse by my very use of them. Evaluative expressions and moral rules are thus both expressions of the agent's fundamental choices. But the role of choice in Hare's prescriptivism is far clearer and far less objectionable than the role of attitudes or feelings was in emotivism. Unlike the latter, it does not preclude the use of argument in morals. Hare was, in fact, a pioneer in the logical investigation of imperatives. He pointed out that in imperatival discourse, conclusions can follow from premises in a perfectly straightforward way, violating none of the ordinary rules of entailment. Because, and therefore, carry their usual meanings, and genuine moral argument is possible. But so Hare further holds, the meaning of evaluative prescriptive expressions is such that no evaluative or prescriptive conclusion can follow from premises which do not include at least one evaluative or prescriptive premise. In other words, Hare reiterates the thesis that no ought follows merely from is. So far as the doctrine of the language of moral goes, it seemed to follow that the pattern of moral argument is a transition from a moral major premise, an effectual minor premise, to a moral conclusion. Whatever I appear to pass from fact to value, I ought to help this man because he is starving. There is a gap in the argument, a concealed major premise. I ought to help the starving. This major premise itself may figure as the conclusion of some other syllogism, but at some point the chain of reasoning must terminate in a principle which I cannot justify by further argument, but to which I must simply commit myself by choice. Once more, it seems to follow, as it did with emotivism, that on matters of ultimate principle, assertion cannot be met by argument, but only by counter-assertion. In Freedom and Reason, Hare argued that this was not entailed by his view, that the universalizability of moral judgments provides an argumentative weapon against those who hold unacceptable moral principles. For a man who holds, for example, that other men ought to be treated in certain unpleasant ways merely because their skins are black, we can always ask, are you then prepared to allow that you should be treated in the same way if your skin were black? And Hare believes that only a minority, whom he denominates fanatics, would be prepared to accept the consequences of replying yes to this. This last contention is a question of fact on which I believe that recent social history does not bear Hare out. But I do not want to quarrel with this part of Hare's view so much as to emphasize that it still remains true on Hare's view that, as a matter of logic and of the concepts involved, what I call good and what I hold I ought to do depend upon my choice of fundamental evaluations, and that there is no logical limit to what evaluations I may choose. In other words, Hare's prescriptivism is, in the end, a reissue of the view that behind my moral evaluations there is not and cannot be any greater authority than that of my own choices. To understand evaluative concepts is to understand that our use of these concepts does not of itself commit us to any particular set of moral beliefs. The criteria for true belief in matters of fact are independent of our choices. But our evaluations are governed by no criteria but those which we ourselves choose to impose upon them. This is a repetition of Kant's view of the moral subject as lawgiver, but it makes him an arbitrary sovereign who is the author of the law that he utters and who constitutes it law by uttering it in the form of a universal prescription. An ambiguity in Hare's whole enterprise, an ambiguity pointed out by Mary Warnock, becomes important here. Footnote: Ethics Since 1900, pages 128-129. When Hare characterizes evaluation and prescription, is he in fact defining these terms in such a way as to protect his thesis against possible counterexamples? If we produce an example of ought, which does not entail a first-person imperative, or an example of good in which the criteria are not a matter of choice, will Hare be able to reply that these are simply non-prescriptive and non-evaluative uses of ought and good? Hare certainly recognizes that there are some non-prescriptive and non-evaluative uses, but if he has simply legislated so that evaluation and prescription shall be what he says they are, why should we assent to his legislation? If he is not legislating, then we must have the class of evaluative and prescriptive expressions delimited for us independently of Hare's characterization in a way that Hare himself never delimits it. He seems indeed to rely on an almost intuitive understanding of what is to be included or left out of the class of evaluative expressions. Why is this important? It is important partly because Philippa Foot and Peter Geach have challenged Hare with prima facie convincing counterexamples. Footnote. Moral Arguments in Mind, 1958, Good and Evil in Analysis, Volume 17. Philippa Foot's attention has been concentrated on evaluative expressions connected with the virtues and vices, such as rude and courageous, Geertz on good and evil. The criteria for the correct application of rude and courageous are, so Mrs. Foot argues, factual. If certain factual conditions are fulfilled, this is sufficient to show that these epithets apply and their application could only be withheld by someone who failed to understand their meaning. So if a man at a concert spits in the face of an acquaintance whom he knows slightly and who has done nothing hostile to him, then he is certainly rude. Equally, if a man with a reasonable prospect of saving the lives of others by sacrificing his own does sacrifice his own life, he is certainly courageous. But in each of these cases, when we show that the necessary and sufficient conditions apply to justify the epithet, we could rewrite what we say so that the necessary and sufficient conditions appear as premises which, in virtue of the meaning of rude or courageous, entail the conclusion, so he was rude or so he was courageous. But if any conclusions are evaluative, these are. Thus, some factual premises do appear to entail evaluative conclusions. Equally, it is clear that in many cases, at least where I call something or someone good, the appropriate criteria are determined by the kind of case it is and are not open to choice. The criteria for calling something a good X depend, as Geertz has pointed out, on the nature of X. A good watch, a good farmer, a good horse are cases in point. But what about a good man? Here surely it might be argued we do use a variety of criteria and we have to choose between them. Here surely an argument like Hare's is the convincing one. I do not want to pursue this as yet unfinished argument further. I want rather to inquire what sort of argument it is and why it arises. It is important to see that a whole range of interconnected differences of view are involved here. On the one side, it is held that facts can never entail evaluations, that philosophical inquiry is neutral between evaluations, that the only authority which moral views possess is that which we as individual agents give to them. This view is the final conceptualization of the individualism, which has had recurrent mention in this history. The individual becomes his own final authority in the most extreme possible sense. On the alternative view, to understand our central evaluative and moral concepts is to recognize that there are certain criteria we cannot but acknowledge. The authority of those standards is one that we have to recognize, but of which we are in no way the originators. Philosophical inquiry, which reveals this, is therefore not morally neutral, and factual premises do, on occasion, entail evaluative conclusions. Each view systematically insulates itself from the other by its choice of examples. And neither will allow that the issue between them could be settled by an empirical inquiry into the way in which evaluative concepts are actually used. For each is quite prepared to allow that the ordinary usage in morals may on occasion be confused or indeed perverted through the influence of misleading philosophical theory. Perhaps, however, this controversy is one that cannot be settled, and perhaps the reason why it cannot be settled can be seen if we try to place in historical perspective the concepts which generate it. But before we can do that, we must consider certain very unsophisticated points which locate this controversy as one not merely for philosophers, but for all contemporary moral agents. Emotivism and prescriptivism initially alienate us because their explanations of evaluative language in terms of the notions of feelings, liking, choice, and imperatives leave us asking why there should exist any specifically evaluative language over and above the ordinary language of feelings, liking, choice, and imperatives. When I say you ought to do this, or when I say this is good, I want to protest that I say more and other than you or anyone else do this, or I like this, do so as well. For if that is what I mean, that is what I could and would say. If that is what I do say, then certainly what I say will have no authority but that which I confer upon it by uttering it. My attitudes and my imperatives have authority for me just because they are mine. But when I invoke words such as ought and good, I at least seek to appeal to a standard which has other and more authority. If I use these words to you, I seek to appeal to you in the name of those standards and not in my own name. Yet even though this may be what I seek to do, it does not necessarily follow that I succeed. Under what conditions might I succeed? Under what conditions must I fail? Suppose a society of the kind which I tried to characterize when I discussed Greek society, in which the form of life presupposes agreement on ends. Here there are agreed criteria for the use of good, not only when we speak of good horse and good farmer, but also when we speak of good man. In this society there is a recognized list of virtues, an established set of moral rules, an institutionalized connection between obedience to rules, the practice of virtues, and the attainment of ends. In such a society, the contrast between evaluative language and the language of liking or of choice will be quite clear. I may tell you what I like or choose, and I may tell you what you ought to do. But the second makes a claim upon you which the first does not. You may disregard what you ought to do through annoyance or negligence, but you cannot use the moral vocabulary and consistently deny the force of ought, and you cannot remain within the social commerce of the community and abandon the moral vocabulary. Is moral criticism in such a society impossible? By no means, but it must proceed by an extension of and not by a total break with the established moral vocabulary. Does this mean that the authority of the morality does not extend beyond the community whose social practices are in question? One is tempted to rely, does the authority of arithmetical rules extend beyond the community in which the practice of counting is established? This is intended as a genuine and not as a rhetorical question, which deserves a fuller answer. But at the least, to connect rules and social practice in this way is not obviously to give moral rules less of a hold on us than mathematical, except that no society could advance far without the same type of simple counting, whereas there can be wide variations in the social practice to which moral rules are relevant. In discussing Greek society, I suggested what might happen when such a well-integrated form of moral life broke down. In our society, the acids of individualism have for four centuries eaten into our moral structures for both good and ill. But not only this. We live with the inheritance of not only one, but of a number of well-integrated moralities. Aristotelianism, primitive Christian simplicity, the Puritan ethic, the aristocratic ethic of consumption, and the traditions of democracy and socialism have all left their mark upon our moral vocabulary. Within each of these moralities, there is a proposed end or ends, a set of rules, a list of virtues. But the ends, the rules, the virtues differ. For Aristotelianism, to sell all you have and give to the poor would be absurd and mean-spirited. For primitive Christianity, the great souled man is unlikely to pass through that eye of the needle, which is the gateway to heaven. A conservative Catholicism would treat obedience to established authority as a virtue. A democratic socialism, such as Marx, labels the same attitude servility and sees it as the worst of vices. For Puritanism, thrift is a major virtue, laziness a major vice. For the traditional aristocrat, thrift is a vice, and so on. It follows that we are liable to find two kinds of people in our society. Those who speak from within one of these surviving moralities, and those who stand outside all of them. Between the adherents of rival moralities, and between the adherents of one morality and the adherents of none, there exists no court of appeal, no impersonal neutral standard. For those who speak from within a given morality, the connection between fact and valuation is established in virtue of the meanings of the words they use. To those who speak from without, those who speak from within appear merely to be uttering imperatives which express their own liking and their private choices. The controversy between emotivism and prescriptivism on one hand and their critics on the other thus expresses the fundamental moral situation of our own society. We can, in the history of moral philosophy, situate certain writers usefully in terms of this account. Kant, for example, stands at the point at which the loss of moral unity means that morality can be specified only in terms of the form of its rules and not of any end which the rules may serve. Hence his attempt to derive the content of moral rules from their form. Kant also stands at the point at which moral rules and the goals of human life have become divorced to such a degree that it appears both that the connection between abiding by the rules and achieving the goals is merely a contingent one, and that, if this is so, it is intolerable. It is Kant's grasp of the former point, as well as of the vagueness about goals, which had led to the notion of happiness becoming vague and indefinite, that leads him to enjoin us to seek not to be happy, but to be deserving of happiness. It is his grasp of the latter point that leads him to invoke God as a power that will crown virtue with happiness after all. Kant seeks to hold together an earlier and a later view of morals. The tension between them is apparent. 18th century English moralists and 19th century utilitarians write from within a society in which individualism has conquered. Hence they present the social order not as a framework within which the individual has to live out his moral life, but as the mere sum of individual wills and interests. A crude moral psychology makes of moral rules instructions as to effective means for gaining the ends of private satisfaction. Hegel, Green, and to a lesser extent Bradley are not only critics of this view of morals, they try to specify the type of community within which the moral vocabulary can have a specific and distinctive set of uses. But the philosophical analysis of the necessary form of such community is no substitute for the deed of recreating it. And their natural successors are the emotivists and the prescriptivists, who give us a false account of what authentic moral discourse was, but a true account of the impoverished meanings which evaluative expressions have come to have in a society where a moral vocabulary is increasingly emptied of content. Marx resembles Hegel and the English idealists in seeing a communal framework as presupposed by morality. Unlike them, he sees that it no longer exists. And he proceeds to characterize the whole situation as one in which moralizing can no longer play a genuine role in settling social differences. It can only be an attempt to invoke an authority which no longer exists and to mask the sanctions of social coercion. All this, of course, does not entail that the traditional moral vocabulary cannot still be used. It does entail that we cannot expect to find in our society a single set of moral concepts, a shared interpretation of the vocabulary. Conceptual conflict is endemic in our situation because of the depth of our moral conflicts. Each of us, therefore, has to choose both with whom we wish to be morally bound and by what ends, rules, and virtues we wish to be guided. These two choices are inextricably linked. In choosing to regard this end or that virtue highly, I make certain moral relationships with some other people and other moral relationships with others impossible. Speaking from within my own moral vocabulary, I shall find myself bound by the criteria embodied in it. These criteria will be shared with those who speak the same moral language, and I must adopt some moral vocabulary if I am to have any social relationships. For without rules, without the cultivation of virtues, I cannot share ends with anyone else. I am doomed to social solipsism. Yet I must choose for myself with whom I am to be morally bound. I must choose between alternative forms of social and moral practice. Not that I stand morally naked until I have chosen, for our social past determines that each of us has some vocabulary with which to frame and to make his choice. Nor can I look to human nature as a neutral standard, asking which form of social and moral life will give to it the most adequate expression. For each form of life carries with it its own picture of human nature. The choice of a form of life and the choice of a view of human nature go together. To this view, each side in the contemporary philosophical controversy will reply in its own terms. The emotivists and prescriptivists will stress the role of choice in my account. Their critics will stress the way that the agent must come to the act of choice with an already existing evaluative vocabulary. Each will try by their choice of examples to redefine their opponent's case away. And the same attempt is already being made in other controversies elsewhere. Indeed, it is a reinforcement for the view that this philosophical controversy is an expression of our social and moral situation, that it should have occurred in quite a different context in the arguments that have proceeded in France between Catholic moralists, Stalinists, Marxists, and Sartrean existentialists. For both Catholics and Stalinists, the moral vocabulary is defined in terms of certain alleged facts. Each has their own characteristic list of virtues. For Sartre, by contrast, at least for the Sartre of the immediate post-war period, to live within a ready-made moral vocabulary is necessarily an abdication of responsibility, an act of bad faith. Authentic existence is to be found only in a self-conscious awareness of an absolute freedom of choice. Kierkegaard's view of the act of choice is detached from its theological context and made by Sartre the basis for political as well as for moral decision. Sartre does not locate the source of the necessity of the act of choice in the moral history of our society, and more than Kierkegaard did. He locates it in the nature of man, a conscious being, être pour soi, differs from a thing, être en soi, in his freedom and his consciousness of freedom. Hence, man's characteristic experiences of anxiety before the gulf of the unmade future and their characteristic attempts to pretend that they are not responsible. Thus, Sartre locates the basis of his moral view in a metaphysics of human nature, such as much as the Catholic or the Marxist does. Like Sartre, the prescriptivist and the emotivist do not trace the source of the necessity of choice or of taking up one's own attitudes to the moral history of our society. They ascribe it to the nature of moral concepts as such. And in so doing, like Sartre, they try to absolutize their own individualist morality and that of the age by means of an appeal to concepts, such as much as their critics try to absolutize their own moralities by means of an appeal to conceptual considerations. But these attempts could only succeed if moral concepts were indeed timeless and unhistorical, and if there were only one available set of moral concepts. One virtue of the history of moral philosophy is that it shows us that this is not true, and that moral concepts themselves have a history. To understand this is to be liberated from any false absolutist claims. Kitabın sonu. 11 Nisan 2006. Sayfa 269.